But when you're about to speak and about today's message is from Genesis chapter 26 and it's entitled All's Well That Ends Well. And the reason why I've entitled that, if you've ever read the chapter, you'll figure it out. But let's go ahead and pick up there in verse 1. Now there was a famine in the land besides the previous famine in Abraham's time, and Isaac went to Abimelech, king of the Philistines, in Gerar. The Lord appeared to Isaac and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Live in the land where I tell you to live. Stay in this land for a while, and I will be with you and will bless you. For to you and your descendants I will give all these lands and will confirm the oath I swore to your father Abraham. I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and will give them all these lands, and through your offspring all nations on earth will be blessed because Abraham obeyed me and did everything I required of him, keeping my commands, my decrees, and my instructions." So Isaac stayed in Gerar. So we come across this passage here in Genesis 26 where he says there's a famine. And this is a famine besides the previous famine that had occurred during Abraham's time, his father's time. Back in Genesis 12, we read about that famine. And when there's a famine in that land, often what will happen is people will gravitate down towards Egypt. Why? Because they've got the Nile running through there and it's a very fertile place. That's exactly what his father Abraham did. His father Abraham went down to Egypt. It's later what his son Jacob did when there was a famine. He went down to Egypt where Joseph was second in command. And so that was a common practice. And so Isaac was on his way, decided, okay, there's a famine. I can't stick around here. Here being the promised land in the land of the Canaanites. He's like, I can't stick around here. I've got to go and take care of my family. And so he's on his way, he goes past Gerar. Gerar is where the Philistines were, Abimelech. Abimelech, by the way, we read about an Abimelech back in Genesis chapter 20. That's just the title for the ruler. It literally means son of the king. And so just like we would say the kings of Israel were sometimes known as the sons of David, similarly in the New Testament times, Herod was a title that was often passed down. But Abimelech was he was another king. And he goes past Gerar, and whilst he's there, God actually speaks to him. And God tells him, don't go down to Egypt. He says, stay here in the land, I will bless you. You know, he goes on to renew the covenant he made with Abraham, that through Abraham's descendants, all people on earth will be blessed. He says, He renews this covenant with Isaac as well. And Isaac, we know, was the son of the promise that God had given to Abraham and to Sarah. And so he's reiterating, look, just trust me, I will be your God, you'll be my people, all people, nations will be blessed, you'll have loads of descendants. You just got to obey my commands as your father Abraham did. Now, even though Isaac is the chosen one, even though Isaac was the son of the promise, he still has to go through famines. And you know, it's true for all of us, by the way, just because we are blessed by God, chosen by God, just because we are Christians, doesn't mean that we don't face challenges and we don't face hardships. That those will come into our lives just as it comes into the lives of everyone. The Bible talks about how God sends the rain and the sun on the just and the unjust. We will all experience the hardships, the storms of life. But in the midst of these challenges, the question comes, are we going to trust God and take him at his word and be obedient to his instructions? Or are we going to try and take matters into our own hands and deal with things ourselves? You know, what Isaac chooses to do is he chooses to listen to God, and it says, so he stayed in Gerar. It was a famine, but he stayed. He took God at his word. You know, most of you know that just recently I got back last Monday, from a trip to Singapore. And I was over there because my father had passed away back on Father's Day, in fact. And his funeral was being held out there. And so I went out then. And even before I went, I was feeling kind of challenged by a number of different things. I was feeling challenged mostly because I wasn't sure what kind of reception I might receive when I go out there. You know, my father, he was married at the age of 18. Well, actually, he was 20. His wife was 18. to a Chinese lady. He was born in Malaysia. He was from mixed parentage. His father was Dutch Portuguese. His mother was Chinese. He married a Chinese lady. And they had four children. But then he was unfaithful to his wife and went off with another woman. And then after that other woman paid for him to come to the UK where he met my mother and settled down and had another four children. And then he left my mother and eventually went back to his wife and then had another child. And so I had five half siblings who are all Chinese. And I knew them growing up because they settled in London. And so whenever I went to see my dad, I would get a chance to see his other children and spend time with them. But going to Singapore for my dad's funeral, where a lot of his relatives didn't know about this other family he had in the UK, I felt a little bit of, shall we say, trepidation. Mainly because I was thinking of my father's widow, who I call my aunt, that the fact that I would be a physical embodiment of her husband's adultery. And so I wanted to be sensitive. Should I go? Shouldn't I go? And I was questioning whether I should go or not. And after getting a lot of advice and God working some things out in an incredible way, I decided, you know what, I will go. But I wanted to check first whether it was okay. And I spoke to my sisters, and one of my sisters, she used to live in London, just recently moved out, who we would regularly meet up for times together. I said, can you speak to your mum and ask her how she would feel about me coming to the funeral? And she spoke to her mother, and her mother said, no, it's fine, I'm welcome to come. And so the plan was we were supposed to meet up the day before the funeral. I would fly in on the Monday, we'd meet up a day or two later before the funeral, so that then the first time I was meeting the rest of the relatives wasn't going to be at the funeral itself. As I set off, I got a text saying, oh, for some reason we're not able to meet up before the funeral now. And I was thinking, I hate to just show up at this church service, and then it's all... I just felt awkward about that. But, you know, I prayed and I thought, okay, man, whatever, it's all in God's hands. Whilst I was over there, I was particularly encouraged just to be able to spend time with the brothers and sisters from the church in Singapore. I was there at the church service that Sunday, and they welcomed visitors from around who were visiting the congregation, just as we sometimes do. And they said, you know, we have visitors from Canada, and they got them to stand up. We have visitors from America, they got them to stand up. And then we have visitors from London, and I was sitting on the front row, and I was expecting them to say, Mike from London. And they said, we've got Ezekiel and Tide from London. If you can go ahead and stand. I said, hold on a second. And I looked behind me, and lo and behold, if it's not Ezekiel and Tide from London, as in East London, what are you doing in Singapore? They stood up, and then they introduced me as well. But it was just encouraging just to be there. And we know when I arrived in Singapore, the same day that I flew in was the same day that one of my closest friends, or one of my best friends from 26 years ago, flew in from India with his son, and he was just over there getting some counseling time, and so we were able to spend some time together, and it was just so refreshing to being able to catch up with so many friends that I knew from the past. But, you know, the day before the funeral, I got John Louis said, let me take you out for lunch. And I was staying with John and Karen Louis. John and Karen Louis, they're part of the leadership team there in the Singapore church. In fact, they actually planted the church in Singapore back in 1988. And I was staying in their house. They're both counselors, and that was really helpful because they were giving me lots of counseling about just my childhood and how do I feel about everything coming up. And it was very, very helpful. And John said, let me take you out for lunch tomorrow. And I said, no, I said, it's fine. You guys have done so much for me. He goes, no, I really want to do something for you. And I said, well, somewhere cheap. He says, yeah, I know that's, I knew that's what you would say. He said, but he says, I've got somewhere else in mind. And so the next day we went out for lunch. This was the day before the funeral. We went out for lunch at a really nice place that he likes down in the center of Singapore. And after lunch, we were on our way back to the car park. And as I was walking back to the car park, I felt this tap on my shoulder. And I turned around, and it was my sisters and their mother and other of my father's relatives. They're right there in the middle of Singapore. They'd spotted me in the crowd, and they'd come and it was just so encouraging, and I instantly felt so lifted that I was able to meet everyone before the actual service the following day. That was God. That was God working things out for me. You know, in this situation, Isaac and his family, they'd planned to go down to Egypt. Why? Because they're in the middle of a famine. But God says, stay, and I will take care of you. And you know what? God always does take care of us. By the way, taking care of us doesn't mean that we don't go through the famines. Taking care of us doesn't mean that we don't go through the hardships or the trials. Taking care of us means that we will get through, as long as we hold on to Him. And that's what He does. He promises that for all of us. That if we simply stay close to Him, He will never leave us or forsake us. And He gives this promise to Isaac, just stick around. Stay in the promised land. And so Isaac obeys. Well, let's move on in verse 7. When the men of that place asked him about his wife, he said, "She is my sister," because he was afraid to say, "She is my wife." He thought, "The men of this place might kill me on account of Rebekah, because she is beautiful." When Isaac had been there a long time, Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked down from a window and saw Isaac caressing his wife, Rebekah. So Abimelech summoned Isaac and said, "She's really your wife. Why did you say she is my sister?" Isaac answered him, "Because I thought I might lose my life on account of her." Then Abimelech said, "What is this you have done to us? One of the men might well have slept with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us." So Abimelech gave orders to all the people, "Anyone who harms this man or his wife shall surely be put to death." You know what's interesting? Is that Isaac was willing to trust God and stick around in the land of famine. But then when it came time to, when someone asked him, "Hey, who's this woman with you?" He's like, "Oh, she's my sister." He couldn't trust God enough to protect him from the people. And he lies. And when you read this, you get a sense of deja vu. Because, lo and behold, if his dad, Abraham, the father of faith, didn't do exactly the same thing. Now, it wasn't as bad, because when Abraham, back in Genesis 12, during the famine, he went down to Egypt. Pharaoh spotted Sarah, who was a beautiful woman, and took her to be... Abraham said, "Oh, she's my sister," because he was also afraid that people might attack him because of his wife. But in Abraham's case, his wife really was his half-sister. Like my Chinese sisters, they shared the same father. And so, at least he told a half-truth. Although a half-truth is still broken, right? And you throw broken things away. But nonetheless, there was some justification for what Abraham said. In Isaac's situation... Well, okay, he could say that Rebekah was his cousin, right? His uncle Laban's daughter, and so that they are related. But to say she's his sister is a complete stretch. I mean, there's no way. And he lied. And Abraham, his father, did exactly the same thing, not once, but twice. In fact, Abraham, his father, did the same thing in the same place to the same people. He was in Genesis 20, he was in the land of the Philistines, actually in Gerar as well. And Abimelech, the older Abimelech, also spotted his wife and thought, "Well, she's good looking." And Abraham says, "Oh, she's my sister." And so I wonder where Isaac got the idea from. He wasn't around when all this happened, but I bet he'd heard the stories. And I bet that's probably when he was challenged about, "Well, who is this beautiful woman you're with?" I bet he's thinking out of fear, "Well, she's my sister. Worked for my dad. It'll work for me." You ever notice how sins of the fathers can be repeated in the sins of the children? You know, it's interesting because I look at my the sins of my father, and just the mess that he's caused in his family. And my sisters, my three older sisters, they all married Englishmen. And they all settled down in the UK. And none of them have kids. And I once asked one of my sisters, "Well, why didn't you ever have kids?" "Well, didn't want to." And part of it was because of their own childhood, because their father had abandoned them, and I think it kind of messed them up. And in fact, my oldest brother, my oldest Chinese brother, he had many dysfunctional relationships, and he ended up dying. He probably drank himself to death, is the honest truth. And my younger Chinese brother, he probably had the most stable of all of us, because he had both parents with him when he was growing up. But he's been married, he's been divorced, he's got kids by two different women, and it's a mess. And my brothers on my mum's side, same thing. They've also been through multiple relationships, multiple kids by different women, and the only one who has escaped unscathed, I say unscathed, relatively so, is me. And that's only because I became a Christian when I was 16. And that's only because I made a decision to follow the Bible and not, and hopefully try and break some of the generational patterns of sin. And I look back into my father's life, and he also came from a very dysfunctional childhood. And his father before him had two different wives, and he was the child of the second woman, and I don't know about my grandfather or my great grandfather, but I can imagine that it was just history repeating itself. And so it's hard to say, well, you're to blame. But as for those of us who are parents, be aware that our kids, they see and hear and they imitate, for good or for bad. And we have to take responsibility for our actions. Now, we're not responsible, ultimately, for when our kids grow up and they make their own adult decisions. That's their choice. But as far as it be down to us, let's set an example the way we ought to. I asked Caleb in the car driving to church this morning. I said, so what's the biggest sin that you've seen me commit? I got to be honest, I think I caught him by surprise. He looked at me like this. And then he goes, no, I can't think of any. Right. So I thought I'd make it easier. Okay, what are the top three? He goes, well, yeah. He says, well, you know, I have seen you slander other drivers on the road. I said, what? Slander? What do you mean slander? What, you say bad things about other people's driving? And I was about to say, yeah, but that's not necessarily slander. I mean, I was about to defend myself. I thought, hold on a second. I just asked him to tell me what he sees wrong with me. Why am I going to start defending myself? And I said, well, if that's the worst thing, I'm going to count myself getting off lightly, is all I can say. But I know there have been terrible things that I've done that my kids have seen. I know that for a fact. And in fact, I know because I've had to apologize to them for my behavior. You know, our kids, they do pick up. They do pick up on our behaviors. And we need to make sure that we're serious about following. You know, ever since Caleb made that comment in the car, as I was driving along, some other guy back pulled in front of me, and I didn't say anything. And I said to Caleb, hey, you notice I didn't say anything? He goes, yeah, I noticed that, but it's only because I just said that you'd slide over drivers. And he said, and you were probably thinking that with some. And I said, yeah, you're right, I was thinking that. But anyway, let's carry on, shall we? In verse 12. Isaac planted crops in that land, and the same year reaped 100-fold because the Lord blessed him. The man became rich, and his wealth continued to grow until he became very wealthy. He had so many flocks and herds and servants that the Philistines envied him. So all the wells that his father's servants had dug in the time of his father Abraham, the Philistines stopped up, filling them with earth. Then Abimelech said to Isaac, move away from us, you have become too powerful for us. So Isaac moved away from there and encamped in the valley of Gerar, where he settled. Isaac reopened the wells that had been dug in the time of his father Abraham, which the Philistines had stopped up after Abraham died, and he gave them the same names his father had given them. You know, so after he was fearful and he lied, God still worked powerfully, so Abimelech himself warned the people, don't touch this man's wife. Don't touch her. And then it says that Isaac sowed some seed and God blessed him. You know, this is the grace of God. Because even though Isaac didn't trust God enough and he sinned and he lied, still God didn't treat him as he deserved. Psalms 103 tells us that God doesn't treat us the way our sins deserve. And so that's the amazing thing about the grace of God. Grace is unmerited favor, undeserved favor. All of us, we're all blessed in some way, shape or form. Even the very fact that we are sitting here this morning, dressed and in our right minds, most of us, we have food, we have shelter. You know, God has taken care of us. We have relationships. God has blessed us. But when we look back in our sinful nature, we think, do I really deserve all these blessings? That's the way God works. And so Isaac plants crops, and in verse 12 it says that same year reaped 100-fold. Can you imagine that? I mean, savings right now, if you save it, put your money in the bank, the chances are you may get 2% back after a year, if you're lucky, right? That's one of the top interests. Imagine getting not 2% back, but 100,000% back. Or, I mean, that's pretty awesome. I mean, he was utterly blessed. He was incredibly blessed by God. Actually, I think it's 10,000 times back, 10,000% back. But he was blessed by God in incredible ways, more than he deserved. And it's no wonder it says that he became wealthy. And remember, all of this is occurring during a time of a famine. Who plants seeds and harvests 100 times as much in the time of a famine? It's no wonder then that the Bible tells us in verse 14 that the Philistines envied him. It's the first time in Scripture that the Hebrew word for envy is used. Of course they're envious, because they see, so what on earth is going on? You know what's amazing? Is that here's a guy who is in a covenant with God, and he hasn't behaved like a man of the covenant. He's supposed to be a follower of the one true God, and yet he's lived a lie, pretending that his wife was his sister, and he lived that lie for quite some time. And it was only, and he didn't confess it. It was only in verse 8 when it says he'd been there a long time that Abimelech saw what was going on. And you know, it's interesting because the Hebrew word for here, the NIV translates it caress, but in the actual word itself, it means to laugh or to mock or to it's like you're playing around, basically. I imagine he was probably tickling his wife. I don't know, maybe something like that, but making her laugh, do something. But it was clearly something of that was more intimate than just a brother and sister. And so he's confronted by a pagan king over his sin, over his lie. And yet still in the midst of that, God chooses to bless him. And the Philistines look and they see, oh my goodness, this guy's getting rich, whereas the rest of us, we're struggling during this time of famine. And no wonder they're envious. And so what they do is, out of spite, they fill up all the wells that his father Abraham had dug. And of course, in that region, water was your lifeline. Not only do you need water to survive, you need water to flourish. And if you have many, many herds and large flocks, you need a lot of water. And so his father dug a lot of wells, but now the Philistines, they fill them all up. Why? Because they're not very happy. You know, people will see our lives as we live out our faith, and you will find that there will be people who don't appreciate you or your life. And you may find you get some kind of pushback. Well, let's carry on in verse 19. Isaac's servants dug in the valley and discovered a well of fresh water there. But the herders of Gerar quarreled with those of Isaac and said, the water is ours. So he named the well Essek because they disputed with him. It means, Essek means dispute. Not Essex, but Essek. And in verse 21, then they dug another well. But they quarreled over that one also. So he named it Sitna. Sitna means opposition, I think it is. Or some commentators think it means accused. That's where the word Satan comes from. But he goes on. He moved on from there and dug another well, and no one quarreled over it. He named it Rehoboth, saying, now the Lord has given us room and we will flourish in the land. Rehoboth means roomy or spacious. And from there he went up to Beersheba. That night the Lord appeared to him and said, I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not be afraid, for I am with you. I will bless you and will increase the number of your descendants for the sake of my servant Abraham. Isaac built an altar there and called on the name of the Lord. There he pitched his tent, and there his servants dug a well. You know, they filled up his father's wells, and because they're envious of the way he's flourishing, and so he decides, you know what, let's just move away. Let's just not get into all of this, all right? And so he does. He moves further into the valley of Gerar, and then he digs a new well, and he finds some water there, and he reopens one of his old father's wells that's been filled in, and he digs a new one, and the locals, they start to dispute it. And they say, no, this is ours. We were here first. We found this. No, you didn't dig that. Oh, my goodness. And you know what? He could have tried. I mean, he was flourishing to the point where later on in the chapter, the king actually comes and says, hey, let's have a peace treaty because you're too powerful for us and we don't want to attack you. You don't want to attack us. He could have defended his well. But he didn't. You know, I went to the cinema recently with my older brother. He's not just my older brother, he's also my bigger brother. I have two older brothers, both bigger. And we went to the cinema together, and to get to our seats, we would have had to go past the guy who was sitting on the end there. I decided, I'm not going to make the guy stand, I'll just walk around. So I walked around, and my brother followed me. Afterwards, driving home, he says, you know, your first mistake in the cinema. I said, my first mistake, like I made many. I knew what he was thinking. I said, you're thinking that I should have walked past that guy and got him to stand, weren't you? He goes, yeah, why not? That's the most straightforward route. The minute you walk around, you're setting the tone. You're letting him know that he has power over you. That's right. This is typical of my family, by the way. There's this staunch genetic disposition of I have to defend my rights. And to a degree, I have that as well. But over the years, as a Christian, I've learned to be a little bit less confrontational. And plus the fact that I was small also helped me to learn to be less confrontational. Whereas both my brothers were both big, and both of them at various times in their lives served as bouncers for various clubs and venues and whatever. And they get some kind of satisfaction from exercising their physiques. But I'm like, I want to take the path of least resistance. All right, Isaac reminds me of me. He's like, okay, you're disputing it? Fine. The worst he'll do is I'll just call the well dispute. And then moves on. And he digs another well. And this other well now, same thing happens. And he's like, okay, fine, I'm going to move somewhere else. And he called that well, you know, accused or opposed. But he doesn't fight for his rights. You know, so often it's so easy for us to want to try and defend ourselves, to want to try and stand up for our rights. And rights mean that actually it is your right. You have the right to stand up and defend yourself. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you always should. You know, Paul says in 1 Corinthians, better to be wronged than to be a bad example. Much rather, he was talking about Christians taking lawsuits against other Christians. He's like, why would you do that? He says, much rather just suck it up. Because your example is so much more important. You know, we can so easily get offended by things and then hang on to that offense. And we want to defend our rights, and we want to stand up for this, and we don't want anyone walking all over us and telling us what to do and how to behave and all of this kind of stuff. And to the point where we go far beyond what is necessary, and then we start developing this kind of militant attitude of, I will not be downtrodden, I will not be taken advantage of. That's ridiculous. Look at the life of Jesus. Did he ever allow himself to be taken advantage of? Yes. He allowed himself to be tortured, abused, nailed to a cross and put to death. Did he deserve any of it? No. And yet when we are called to be his disciples, we are called to take up our cross and follow him. 1 Peter 2 actually specifically tells us that he suffered unjustly and he set an example that we should follow in his steps. When's the last time you allowed yourself to be unjustly treated and not hold a grudge? Jesus prayed for those who mistreated him. He said, Father, forgive them. He didn't say, Father, please send a lightning bolt from heaven and teach them the error of their ways. He didn't say that. He said, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. And our attitude has to be the same. You know, so often we want to have our rights. We want to defend our right to choose, to do what we want to do, instead of having an attitude of, no, I'm going to humbly submit to anyone and everyone. I'm going to trust God that he's going to take care of me, and I'm not going to be the one who has to defend myself. You know, it was great on Friday to just be able to be together and to witness Michael's baptism into Christ. That was really encouraging. In fact, actually, last week, Sharon got baptized. Where is Sharon? Sharon, can I get you to stand? We're going to welcome you into the family. It's encouraging. And then on Friday, Michael got baptized. Michael, can I get you to stand as well? We're going to welcome you into the family. That's encouraging. You know what's sad is a number of us, we missed that. We honestly were probably less than 2/3 of our normal membership. That's actually not right. Because as a congregation, every single one of us who's a member of the church, when we became a member of the church, we said at the point of our baptism, Jesus is going to be Lord. That's what we said. And 1 Corinthians 12 tells us that we were baptized into his body, the church. And I don't know about you, but when I go somewhere, all the parts of my body go with me. I don't leave bits behind. Not even bits I want to discard, whether it's bits of hair or fingernails, or whatever. But I certainly don't leave living bits behind. Now, okay, dead skin cells may slough off, but you do that too. So don't go, But the living bits, we all go together because we're connected. And so where the body goes, every member goes with it. Well then, why weren't you here on Friday? If you missed the baptism, why? What was so important for you to miss seeing a birth into the body? You know, we love it when we hear about people with new children that have been born, right? Daniel and Breen, Breen gave birth to a baby girl just this last week. And it's great seeing Michael and Jolla with their baby here today as well. And that's exciting. You're going to hold up your baby, Michael. And that's encouraging. And we all get fired up by that. It shouldn't be any less for when there's a spiritual birth. And we should all be here. And you can't say, well, this coming Friday, is there going to be a baptism? Because I'm not sure if I'm going to come or not. No, it's not about that. It's about being part of the body. That we're all together. You know what's sad? Is when we have new members born into the family, and they don't have good, positive role models to imitate. Because just like Isaac can look at his dad, Abraham, and Abraham was the father of faith, and he did many things right, but the things he did wrong, it's amazing how people can easily pick up on that. And we can have young Christians born into the fellowship, but they could look around at the good examples, but then they can see the bad examples and use that as an excuse for also being uncommitted. That's not right. We have a responsibility. Just as parents have a responsibility to set an example for the children, so older Christians have a responsibility to set an example for younger Christians. We've got to have a different spirit about that. Let's just quickly finish the chapter, shall we? In verse 26, They answered, meanwhile, Abimelech had come to him from Gerar with Ahuzath, his personal advisor, and Phicol, the commander of his forces. Isaac asked them, "Why have you come to me, since you're hostile to me and sent me away?" They answered, "We saw clearly that the Lord was with you, so we said there ought to be a sworn agreement between us and you. Let us make a treaty with you that you'll do us no harm, just as we did not harm you, but always treated you well and sent you away peacefully, and now you are blessed by the Lord." That's a lie, but nonetheless. Isaac then made a feast for them, and they ate and drank. Early in the next morning, the men swore an oath to each other. Isaac sent them on their way. They went away peacefully. That day, Isaac's servants came and told him about the well they dug, and they said, "We found water." He called it Sheba. And to this day, the name of this town has been Beersheba. When Esau was 40 years old, he married Judith, daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and also Basemath, daughter of Elon the Hittite. They were a source of grief to Isaac and Rebekah. What a sad way to end the chapter. He made a treaty with the Philistines, and then God blessed him. He didn't treat them the way they treated him. He made them a feast, sent them on their way peacefully. And then instantly the news came, "Well, we found even more water." And that was called Sheba, which means seventh, or it can also mean oath, a well of oath. And that was where the town later got the name Beersheba from. In fact, it was that same area that Abraham and his family relocated to after he'd been tested on the mountain of Moriah back in Genesis 22. And he'd passed the test, and then he settled in Beersheba. And Isaac, you know, he followed through. You know, the takeaway of this for all of us is we have to learn to trust God. If we trust God, even sometimes when it goes against logic, to stay in a place where there was famine, but he didn't move because God said, "No, stay." Why? Because this is what was going to be best for him and his family. And he took God at his word and he trusted him. He messed up when he lied about his wife, but God still took care of him because God is always faithful. At the end, his son Esau went off and married two Hittite women, and as a result, He excludes himself from the promise, because the promised land was meant for the descendants of the children of the promise, but the Hittites and all the other Canaanite nations weren't allowed to take part of that. Well, then, so too Esau's family would later be excluded as well from that promise. That's horrible. And who our children marry can have a big effect on us as parents. And for Isaac and Rebekah, it was a source of heartache for the rest of their lives, which is sad to say. My daughter, I've only got one daughter who's married. She married a great guy. Praise God he wasn't a Hittite. And his name is Jack, and he's a Christian, and he's faithful, and it's awesome, and it's exciting. They just announced recently, a couple weeks ago, in Australia, that Sarah and Jack are going to be relocating to London. And so they're going to be here. They've applied for their visa. It takes about 3 or 4 weeks for their visa to come through. But they're going to be relocating to London, and we are excited about that. And I'm looking forward to having family nearby for a short while. They can live with us for a short while. And then as soon as humanly possible, they'll find their own place and live there. And we can still be close, but friends. That'd be awesome. Let's take God at his word, and let's follow his example and not imitate those who set bad examples. Amen.
Well, I'd like to thank Mike for that. I found that a very full. I feel like I've been, you know, at the beginning we talked about water. Refreshing the parched land. I feel like I am now a reservoir. That was fantastic. Just the point about when God says there's going to be a famine and I want you to stay in the land of famine. I thought, whoa, that was good. And then Isaac's attitude to trusting God to a point. And with him, he trusted God. God will provide me with the food, but man, I'm having a hard time with these people. I'm not sure God will protect me, so I'm going to take matters into my own hands, which includes lying and a whole heap of other stuff. You know, I think all of us have a point. We all trust God to a point. And it's worth reflecting, where's your point? And God wants us to trust him completely. And I think if we can figure out where our point is and decide, you know what, I'm going to I'm going to move beyond that, because God is worthy of greater trust. And then also just really thinking about how I treat other people when they may mistreat me, misunderstand me, whether it's in the road or at the workplace, in the neighborhood, in the church. Again, do I tolerate it to a point? And after that, I withdraw, I get an attitude, I whatever. Again, let's think. I think all of us, we have points that we're willing to go to. God was trying to take us way beyond that, because he's that powerful and that amazing. And really appreciate the way Mike just really brought all of us back to Jesus, who is just the perfect example in all of this. Let's really keep him in mind. Mike, thanks for your sermon. Thanks for your sharing as well. Let's thank Mike. So just a reminder that we'll all be back here next Friday for Disciple Makers and Questions of Faith. Let's all stand and we'll finish off.